Everyone except you, Martha. I do excuse Martha.
I'll stay right in the middle because I'm a middle child.
Okay. Would the other sibling panelists please come up? Please take a seat. We're going to just go move right on. Thank you.
It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Holida Wakefield. For those of you who've been around for a long time, Holly needs no introduction to you. She and her husband, Ralph Underwager, have been studying, researching, and collecting information on false accusations since the early 1980s. As Pam mentioned in her speech last night, Holly and her husband, Ralph, have been a tremendous help in getting the False Memory Syndrome Foundation started. They were instrumental in getting our own, my husband and myself's own personal knowledge started also. Pam also mentioned Benton Harbor meeting, which is our first meeting of FMS parents. They helped us find a lot of those people, and they sent us so much useful information. But the letter that they sent that I consider a life-changing event for us was the letter they sent of Pam's first article. And it was so interesting because we got the mail as we were leaving to go on an airplane, and I'm sitting there in the airplane reading this letter, and my husband looked over and said, "What's the matter with you?" So I'm sitting here bawling, and I says, "There's this woman, and she just wrote my story and our story," and I couldn't believe it. And I got home and called their institute and said, "Who is this woman, Pam Fryden? How can I find her?" Well, of course, the rest is history. Here we are 8 years later, our fourth conference, and I have them to thank for that. I was really interested to read some of the different things that Holly has done. She's been an elementary school teacher, a college instructor. She's worked as a statistician for the Veterans Administration. And, of course, she's currently co-director of the Institute for Psychological Therapies in Northfield, Minnesota. She has co-authored many books, Accusations of Child Sexual Abuse, The Real World of Child Interrogations, and of course The Return of the Furies, which you have in your packet if you want to see more information about. I highly recommend you read this. And of course, as an advocate of children's rights, she is frequently invited to speak at symposiums and workshops. I was really interested to see the last paragraph. Many of you may want to read more about her and the nice little book we have here. She views the false memory crisis with both optimism and pessimism. On the bright side, of course, the more bizarre claims, such as SRA, are now discredited. I'm not even sure about that. Some of it's still going on, of course. However, she adds this warning. If the American Psychological Association fails to take a stronger stand than it has to date, psychology risks being discredited as a profession. We are very fortunate to have her in our midst. Thank you.
When Alan asked me to chair this particular panel, I thought, well, I'm going to look into our research and see what brilliant insights from the science of psychology I can come up with on siblings, how it affects them, what's the most effective way to react, and I thought I would have my brilliant, knowledgeable, professional insights to add to their personal stories. There are no brilliant professional insights. What we know, what information there is, resides within the siblings. There's really nothing that's been written outside of the personal stories in Eleanor Goldstein's book. It was really the only thing I found. So I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to introduce the panel. We are going to try to keep it short and have lots of time for questions. Starting closest to me, and there's a description of each of these people in the program. Nancy Haggerty, who is the False Memory Syndrome Foundation volunteer from New Jersey. Eric Kroc, he's the volunteer contact from California, and he is a computer internet expert, and as you see in the program, has a webpage, www.stopbadtherapy.com, which I'm going to look at as soon as I get home. Then we have Martha Churchill, who you've already heard from and heard introduced. Martha has written some really good stuff. I have several of her articles. And then Susan Ford, who is going to present a very interesting and extremely valuable perspective on potential legal problems and lawsuits that can directly affect siblings and what siblings might do to head these off at the pass. Okay, Nancy?
Thank you, Holly. As I look out over this audience, I am overwhelmed with heartache. I was a sibling who, along with my mother, who's in the second row here, my adorable mother, Joan Thayer, and my other sister, thanks, Mom. My mother, for any man who's ever been accused of this, is your dream wife. My sister accused my father almost 20 years ago. It was in about 1980. I won't bore you with all of the particulars because we've all got the similar same story. It's just classic. It was just ahead of its time. My initial reaction and that of my other sister and my other brother, that if we weren't so sickened and nauseated at that first accusation, we would have laughed. And it was laughable. And that was our reaction, and that's the reaction which we maintained and sustained. I understand that all families have different dynamics, and I appreciate that. And I can't suggest how a sibling should react or respond. I can only share with you how we did and how we chose to respond. And that was with absolute, unequivocal support. To the point where, if my dad didn't say anything for a few months, we would say, "Dad, is there anything else we should try? Is there anything else you can think of? Do you want us to write another letter? Should one of us try to call her again? Mom, what do you think? Whatever you want, we will do." This is how we chose to react. And I've listened to so many stories over the year, and what's a tremendous heartache as I perceive it is when there are other siblings, your other children, who are, let's face it, your last lifeline in many respects to your sanity, when they aren't as supportive as that. I truly cannot understand it from a compassionate sibling child point of view. However, again, I don't know the dynamics and the build-up resentments and the sibling rivalries and so forth. We just didn't have those in our family. My father died 3 years ago without ever having any resolution. He knew he was dying. He had had a heart attack and he was getting weaker. And he said, "Today is graduation day," the day he died. And he told my mom and my brother and my sister and I, he took us aside and said a lot of sweet, cute, fun, dear things. But one of them was, "Please don't go through life bitter. You must try to forgive your sister. She has suffered as much as we have." And so my mom and I do try every day to try to forgive my sister. And heck, if my dad could have that attitude in the end, and believe me, he suffered. He went through all the emotions all of you dear, wonderful men have. If he could try to maintain that attitude, we certainly could also try. There was a point about 3 or 4 years ago when we knew my dad was getting quite ill that we did try to get together with my sister. And again, we had the phone calls. We tried everything over those 20 years. But there was a period of 13, 14 years she would not have anything to do with us unless Dad went to treatment at a pedophile clinic in Connecticut. And you know, we just said, "Terry, you know where we live. God bless you. We love you. When you get well and you wake up from your delusions, give us a call." Well, she never really did. But there was a time 3, 4 years ago when Dad was getting ill and we called her and told her. She basically made some overtures that she would like to be a returnee. We didn't know, of course, the term at the time. As a family, we couldn't live with that. We just couldn't. That was our choice. I understand that you all make choices that are different. But for us, it was an untenable situation to have that type of relationship. And I said to my sister at that time, one of the few times I've talked to her in 20 years, and understand, I adored her. She was my big sister. And in fact, we're almost identical twins in every respect. But I said to her, Terry, this man who you think is the devil incarnate is my life's teacher. I can't be in the same room with you when you feel that way. So this is how we responded. This is how we reacted. I know I was a blessing to my father, and I have no regrets. There's nothing I didn't do. There's nothing I didn't try. And I will tell you this, that I'm still here. I'm still a daughter. And if there's anything I can ever do for any of you, my name's Nancy Thayer Haggerty. I live in Northern New Jersey. I'm the Northern New Jersey state contact. You call me. If I can talk to you, if you'd like me to meet with any of your children, if you'd like me to go meet your daughter's therapist, if there's write a letter, I'll offer to you what I offered to my dad. Anything I can possibly do. But again, I don't have the answers. If I did, I would have figured them out for my own dad. But I am here for you. So, my heart's with you, and God bless.
So, thank you. That was excellent. My name is Eric Kroc. I just started as the Northern California contact. I want to thank all of you who have been playing that role for so much longer, because the FMS Foundation was a lifeline and a godsend when this first happened to myself and my family. So, and as was mentioned before, I've created my own personal website, stopbadtherapy.com, so do check that out. It says a lot more than I'll have time to say up here. So, in the unlikely event my sister ever listens to this tape, I just want to say that I love you, and I'm not angry, and I would really just like to go on with our lives and move forward. So, a little background on what happened to my family. I think this story will be familiar to most of you here. In our particular case, my mother happens to have multiple sclerosis, and that meant that she had repeated hospitalizations on an emergency basis throughout her early childhood, and was increasingly weak, and this has obviously been a great strain on the whole family. And during early teenage years, my sister began to show signs of depression, and her psychologist reached the fairly obvious conclusion that most likely the cause of this depression was the stress that was a result of my mother's illness. And I don't think you really need a degree to reach that conclusion. I agree with it wholeheartedly. So as time went on, and she got appropriate responsible psychological treatment, but as things turned out, her depression worsened, and when she entered college, the symptoms became more pronounced. I won't go into details here since it's a public forum, but she resumed treatment with other therapists, and as I learned many, many years later, somewhere along the way, read The Courage to Heal, and Secret Survivors, and John Bradshaw and the Family, and some of our other favorite books. So, sometime after she entered this therapy in college, she, in her words, recalled having been sexually molested by a pastor at a local church. This would not require a belief in massive repression, because it would have happened well outside the period of infantile amnesia, and also it could simply be something she had not thought about in a long period of time. At the time, it seemed somewhat plausible. And then, as time went on, she then made an additional accusation against my maternal grandfather, God rest his soul, and who had already passed away. So at this point, I found myself, as the title of this sibling panel suggests, in the middle. And I felt a sense of paralysis. On the one hand, I felt the only thing I could do, I didn't think it was my position to judge. I couldn't speak with my grandfather, had passed away. And I felt the only thing I could do was offer unconditional love. And unquestioning support, and I agree with the first, although the second, I've had much cause later to reconsider whether that was the best approach. Although thinking back with the benefit of hindsight, all I think I could have done really was to have triggered the ultimate rift earlier than it ultimately happened. My sister was already so committed to this course of action that I don't think anything I could have said would have done anything but alienate her. One thing I do wish I'd done more of was research more of these claims of memory repression, memory recovery at the time, and learn more about it. I don't think I would have changed the outcome, but I would have been better prepared to deal with it. At any rate, the accusations increased in number, and against vague individuals, never specified who, and I would hear about these things indirectly through my mother, who I never really discussed it directly with my sister. She didn't raise it with me, except the initial ones against the pastor and the grandfather. The more accusations there were, the more skeptical I became in this whole thing, and yet I felt paralyzed. I didn't feel that I could discuss this openly with my sister because I knew that I knew intuitively that were I to express my doubts that she would cut me off, and I was only too right. And in fact, there was even one point where I had a conversation with my mother, and I felt embarrassed to even suggest the possibility, but I said, you know, I got to be honest and say that the more these accusations go on and the longer this goes on, the more I'm having real doubts about what's happening here. And I also noticed that first there was an accusation against the pastor, and then there was an accusation against the grandfather, and I thought about the sniper scope on a sniper rifle, and I felt perhaps myself or my father might be in the center, and who would be the next target as the accusations moved in. But, you know, I had been exposed to some of this New Age thinking myself, and I thought, no, Eric, because of the stress of dealing with this illness in the family, you're too prone to be over-controlling and try to get too much control over life, so you need to learn to let go. Oh, what an irony. Yes, it's a good life lesson, but that was the wrong time to start applying this in 2020 hindsight. So later, my sister decided to stop traditional therapy against medical advice, went off her medication, and decided to pursue alternative medicine. I wish Andrew Weil were here today. And as we later discovered, of course, she was an adult at this point, and we had no control over the matter. All we could do was be loving and supportive. So as we later discovered, she then, after a marathon series of alternative health practitioners of different kinds, finally discovered a memory recovery therapist who specialized in treating ritual abuse survivors. Why do I know this? Because I have the business card and the canceled checks and everything else. So, surprise, surprise, after she'd been in intensive therapy with this individual for a few months, all without our knowledge, we only found out about it after the fact, we got the letter, and the letter announced, to my great surprise, that supposedly both sets of her parents, grandparents had headed satanic cults, and that supposedly every time either set visited us or we went to visit either set, supposedly both my sister and I were the victims of ritual satanic abuse, including animal sacrifice, human sacrifice of babies, children, and adolescents, cannibalism, and supposedly myself, my father, all four grandparents, friends of the family, and local doctors all participated in these rituals. Now, you may be wondering how my mother, bedridden with multiple sclerosis, was participating in all of this. Well, there was an explanation for that as well. Supposedly, drugs were administered to her so that she would not remember that any of this occurred. There's an explanation for everything, right? So, obviously, there's not a word of truth to any of this. This is all false memories induced by highly suggestive leading therapy that appears to have included the use of hypnosis. But my sister, in the typical pattern, announced she was cutting off all contact with the family. We never had a chance to discuss this matter with her at all. She then disappeared. And then worse, we got a call a couple weeks later from the police announcing they discovered her car abandoned on a rural road outside of town with the door open, the lights on, the battery run down, and a woman's shoe in the road in front of the car. Well, you can imagine the kinds of scenarios that ran through our mind at this point. Fortunately, my father and I were able to confirm within a few days of arriving that she'd been seen alive since then. So we knew this was just part of the disappearance that she'd arranged. So anyway, comments I want to make about this experience. First, I believe this is harder on the parents than it is on the children, because when this happens to the parents, there is a natural and irrational but natural reaction, oh, what did I do to cause this? And it isn't something that you did to cause this. The answer is not in the past, but rather in the present, in the therapy that your children went through. For myself, though, it was the most shattering experience of my entire life. It was the first and only time in my life that I've been out of control of my own emotions. I couldn't feel happy for the longest time, and that was totally alien to me because I normally have a very positive, energetic, outlook on life. For 6 months, there was a period where I knew it would be less painful not to be alive than to go on, but I went on because I happened to be incredibly stubborn, and there was never any risk that I would take my own life or do something irrational like that. So anyway, what have I done? So our choice has been to keep contact with her as much as possible. We were able to continue sending letters. My mother sent letters, my father sent letters, I sent letters. Just try to be warm and friendly. We never admitted anything that we didn't do. And as it happened, my sister's therapist passed away. And about a year after that happened, my mother got a first card from my sister. And then in Thanksgiving, we got a long letter announcing that she was now in pastoral counseling, that for the first time she was in counseling that meets her needs, that she's no longer angry at anyone, and that she wants to focus on the present and go forward. And our choice has been that we think the best approach is not to fight this with logic for our own selves, and different people will make different choices, but rather that by hopefully reestablishing that emotional contact through friendly letters and chit-chat, that maybe we can reestablish communication. And so now I've been able to enjoy the simple joy of sending her cards and presents for herself and her child. So what have we learned from this experience? First, the power of love. In spite of everything that we've been through, I love my sister, and nothing will ever change that. I know that now. Second, that while there is still life, there is hope. Third, that the problem here is unsafe, untested therapy techniques, and this battle is not over until we test therapies for safety and effectiveness the same way we test medicines. I would encourage all of you to not give up and rather to fight back. My personal approach has been to create a website called stopbadtherapy.com to hopefully educate people and prevent this kind of tragedy happening to other families. And I ask that all of you support the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, that we ask not what the FMS Foundation can do for us, but rather ask what we can do for the FMS Foundation. And that in particular, we ask not what Pam can do for us, but that we ask what we can do for Pam. So I'd like to conclude by reciting the entire text of one of Winston Churchill's greatest speeches. Never give up. Never give up. Never give up. Thank you.
I was living in Chicago researching electromagnetic fields when one day I had lunch with my sister and discovered that my dad was a perpetrator of all kinds of physical abuse. And my older sister, who is a mental health professional, is very convincing and charismatic, and she's always been right before, and she's always known the best answer. And I assumed she must have something here, and I started going, wow, P. Pride did, you know, and I started trying to figure it out. And then it got into the sexual abuse. I won't give you the details, as usual, you know. So let me say there's 7 children in my family. I'm one of the middle children. And my oldest sister, who's a mental health professional, started out with the physical abuse stuff, and I thought, wow, probably true. And then she worked around to the incest stuff, which us sisters, we're mostly sisters. There's 5 girls and 2 boys. So we sisters, you know, we trade our dreams around. We call each other up. Boy, I had this dream. I put it in my journal. You know, because we're all reading the literature. We know all the scientific stuff about dreams. It's important to keep track of them in journals, you know, and share them with each other. And, you know, we were all reading John Bradshaw, so we'd be up on all this, and we'd know how to identify a dysfunctional family, which ours obviously was, I mean, of course. And so we were trading our dreams around everything. And then my sister started talking about the incest and so forth, and I thought, geez, I don't really remember this exactly, but probably happened. And you know how people repress these memories. I must have repressed my memories. And I found a therapist in Chicago who's, I found out from her reputation, I searched around to find one that specialized in incest matters, and I went to see her. And she didn't pull anything out of me. I was ready to be pulled, but she didn't do that, actually. And I also went to see a therapist in the Detroit area, which is where I had lived previously. I'm from Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. And I had a therapist from the, you know, being a yuppie type middle class professional uprising person like I was, you know, you have to go to a psychiatrist or a professional of some sort and figure out something wrong with you. All your friends are seeing therapists. Well, anyway, I wasn't about to be left. So I had a therapist back in Detroit. So I went to see her about this, and she said, you know, it's okay to be doubtful about this. It's possible that your older sister had this happen to her and that it didn't happen to you. It's possible it happened to her or it didn't. And you don't have to know the answer to that question. And she left me with that it's okay to be in doubt. And boy, am I glad she did that. She actually had gone into retirement without any help from Chris Barden. And she made an exception to see me and give me that wonderful advice. But meanwhile, it was sort of shaping up like the Civil War in my family, as some of my sisters were going along with the accusations and some were going, no, it's bunk. And for me, being an attorney, you know, my jury was still out. So I was busy reading Courage to Heal, and I'm a real avid reader, so I read it cover to cover, and I gave copies of it to my friends. Boy, this is good, you know. And we were sharing all our dreams and everything. And my parents heard about the False Memory Syndrome Foundation and started getting the literature. And while I was visiting my perpetrator parents one evening, and I had my purse right next to me so that in case they did anything too dysfunctional, I could run out the door and I wouldn't have to. And I was reading this FMS stuff, and I said, boy, this is interesting, you know, can I borrow this? And I took it to some friends of mine in Oak Park. We were sitting around talking about everything. And then they had that conference in East Lansing, an FMS conference, and I was starting to get more and more suspicious of my older sister's accusations. Although some of my sisters were not suspicious at all, and one of them went along, I call her the Me Too accuser, because she wasn't sure what my oldest sister was accusing Dad of, but whatever it was, it must be true. So I called her the Me Too accuser. She's since come around. She now says that let the past be the past, and that what happened, whether it happened, doesn't matter, but we should get on with the future. And she's what I would call a sort of a returnee, kind of a Me Too returnee. And she's... she's really decent. One of the reasons that I moved back to Michigan, I had since gone to New Mexico too, but that's another story I won't get to. I lived in Roswell. And it's a great place to study mass hysteria. I mean, you know, the stories just come crashing down around you. Well, so I moved back to Michigan because I really do love my family. And I don't have a husband at the moment or any kid. I had a husband once, and you know how it is, husbands, you get rid of them. I don't have any kids. So I moved back to Michigan just to be close to my parents. And then, but anyway, while I was in Chicago, though, let me get back. I was in Chicago, and my mom said, your dad and I are going to this FMS conference in East Lansing. If you want to come, we'll pay your way. So I thought, okay, I'll go. And that's where I ran into, you know, Paul Simpson and Chris Barden and the usual suspects. And that's where I created my cartoon that some of you may have seen or heard about. It's the one that shows the robbery in the downtown Detroit, in a downtown area with the tall skyscrapers around, and the guy has his hands up in the air, and the robber is holding a gun in one hand and the wallet in the other hand, And the robber says, and now to make sure you forget this robbery ever happened, I'm going to sexually molest you. While I was at this conference, I realized, I mean, I'd been putting it off. I realized that some of the nasty things I'd said about or to my dad, you know, I was like, you're watching John Bradshaw on TV and your dad calls and you just tell him where to go in no uncertain terms and stuff like that. So, I mean, I'd been more than rude, and I went ahead and apologized to my mom and dad. For the things that I had done, and I'm not going to tell you what I told them that I was sorry for. I'm going to leave that out. But I did apologize to them. That was very hard. And one of the lessons that teaches me is how hard it is for people to apologize. And I had only started going down that road. I had only taken a couple of steps. Can you imagine how hard it would be to apologize if I had gone all the way down that road, which I was trying to travel? And it just, like, I've got goosebumps just thinking of it. It's just like, oh, no. Well, so I did move back to Michigan, and last year, let me just say my oldest sister who made the accusations still making the accusations. So. And she will talk to my parents occasionally, but she won't talk to me because I'm an FMS person. But she says if my memories ever come, she says, Martha, if your memories ever come back to you, I'll be here for you. Yeah. And you have to accept that as the loving part of her reaching out to me. And she does love me, but she won't speak to me. She'll give a Christmas card to my mentally retarded brother and not send one to me because I'm an FMS person. I go to conferences. So last year my dad had really bad chest pain, and so he said, Martha, you better call 911. So I got in the car, went behind the ambulance, and it's a good thing I'm trained as a lawyer. I can chase, you know, an ambulance pretty good. So we got to the hospital, and I guess sitting on that hospital gurney like that, hooked up to tubes, my dad just started thinking about a few things, and he said, Martha, if your older sister wants to come to my funeral, she can't. That occasion should arise.
In reference to what Eric and Martha said, and some couple of conversations I had this morning about therapy, and it occurred to me that for many of you, you belong, those of you who are accused or your partner, your spouse is accused, you belong to an era where therapy was not a central part of life. And when I hear Eric and I hear Martha and I look at my experience, therapy has been a central part of my life or my friends' lives. We believe in therapists. We have ultimate faith in therapists. You can't imagine what your children and their siblings may have experienced. And that's a real quandary because we have a lot of faith in therapists. It's certainly being shattered now. But prior to that, there was an enormous amount of faith. So when you feel hurt that your child's, your accuser's siblings seem to be straddling the fence or questioning or possibly beginning to have those little doubts, take into account that they have a faith in therapy and an experience of therapy that you never had in all likelihood. And I think that's a real important context that you need to remember, that they're having to not only deal with their own grief about you, the parent, but they're having to deal with their own grief about their relationship with that sibling, and then they're also going through a crisis of faith in a belief system themselves. And I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but it seems to me that that's something that we need to look at just as a context what's going on. And also, I'm in the child welfare field. I train people to do, well, unfortunately, I got some feedback on this too, child protective services. Well, you know, I have my own professional system, you know, and so I had to kind of do a lot of rethinking, restructuring, reframing of my entire existence and what I believed in and my professional training. So anyway, if you could address that.
This is something that we as siblings have discussed at length. And again, we all react so differently. And there is no right or wrong, and there is no for sure answer. But I do commiserate with those family members, those accused, who have children who seemingly straddle the fence. For many of us, it seems a pretty black and white issue. Either you believe your father's innocent or you believe he's guilty. That's how easy it was for me. And my other siblings, I understand it's not that easy for others. But there does come a point, maybe after a year or two or three, when your child or your other siblings, do their research and do their thinking and try to play the advocate for both sides and try to mediate. There does come a point, I would think, from my perspective, where maybe you have to call them out a bit and say, hey, you know what, we need some help here. Your mom and I are dying here. We need some help. We dedicate our lives to you. This is the worst nightmare of our life. We need you. Now that's a dangerous, it's a courageous move. It also has repercussions and consequences. But at some point, after 2, 3, 5, 6 years, time typically, in our experience, is not your friend. So as time lingers on, if you have to try to rally your children for some help, there are some possible advantages for that. At least that you might encourage that they withdraw some of their support. You know, pull out a leg of that stool for the accusing daughter. Maybe let her fall. It's called tough love, too. But it's just one perspective.
Let's see, we only have about 4 minutes, but I'd like to get these two questions in.
Okay, I just wanted to say something for a bit of obscure advice from the ACLU. This in the United States, there are state laws about taping, and this is even for your own benefit, even if you never share it with anybody else. In Pennsylvania, it happens to be a felony if you do it without explicit permission of the person you're talking to.
Minnesota, you can do it.
Right, I say it varies state by state. So
you
I just
can tape in Michigan. As long as you're a party to the conversation,
right,
you can tape
it. But you can't
Michigan.
Do it in Pennsylvania without explicit permission, even if you don't. Even
check
if you,
your lawyer.
Didn't that happen
you
in
Michigan? You've got to check with your lawyer
case,
first.
Somebody
I just
got in trouble.
Why is that? Yep.
I am one of the accused, but I'd like to speak to my children, who were not the accusers. My two daughters, youngest daughters, their mother was into a psychotherapy cult. They read Courage to Heal. They followed Bradshaw. And the cult called Reevaluation Counseling encouraged early memories and to find sexual memories, you could find them. Since my former spouse was involved in all this, my son, who's the oldest, and there's three daughters, decided that I probably was guilty because he had to support his mother, you know, the primogeniture. And I entertain children. I'm a puppeteer, I entertain children. And he called me one day and said, or he wrote a letter, and said if I didn't discontinue entertaining children, he would write to every mayor and police chief in the state of Connecticut. Well, it takes a lot to get me angry. I called him back and said, son, the idea was, but I didn't settle with my wife's divorce settlement at her terms, he would do this. And I called him and said, you knew you could be subject to both civil and criminal penalties with blackmail. And he pulled back. My action, oldest daughter was not involved in this counseling, nor was he. And she maintains a good relationship with her sisters, doesn't want to spoil that, and has an excellent relationship with me. To bring my son around, I sent both my former spouse and him all the announcements about the false memory conferences and invited them to come at my expense. I knew they wouldn't come, but I called their bluff. And I've gone fairly public with the whole thing. I've done sermons on it on the subject. He's reached a point now where we don't talk about it, but he's extremely supportive. And my daughter-in-law, who was also accused and also supported the accusers, I talked to her the other day about the wonderful work that he's doing in his business, and I said, he sure didn't learn this from me. And he said, he learned an awful lot from you. So you keep at it, you show love, and let them know, give them the information, thanks to the foundation, they can, your siblings can come around.
Yeah, I'd just like to mention one thing I neglected to mention during my presentation, which is that I personally am a very logical person, but people are different in that. There might be a spectrum of people who are more rational on one end, and then people who are more intuitive or emotional on the other end.
Move your hand away from me.
Right. And then, of course, there's Martha's way over here. But the comment I would make is that this kind of belief system is never one that was based on logic in the first place. And so one thing you'll want to evaluate is whether logic and reason, even necessarily information, will be the most effective tool in your particular case. And again, it will vary from case to case. It just can, remember, that's one of a selection of tools at your disposal.
Okay, I think I chimed this up.